This is Romany Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Rookie Magazine, Glamour Magazine, and Literary Hub Magazine. Our theme today is Speaking Up and Speaking Out, and our first article on that theme is from Rookie Magazine, written by Mia Sabjali, and it's called Talk It Through. Being a writer on the internet used to be my greatest secret. Though I was proud of my work on Rookie, I distanced my internet self from my real-life self as though they were two individuals with nothing in common. I never published under my full name. Only this year did I start sharing my writing on social networks because my followings consisted primarily of people from school. I mostly wrote nonfiction, and I couldn't imagine anything more horrible than my classmates reading my essays and establishing connections between my words and actual events and humans. It would be the equivalent to strolling naked through our school's hallways in broad daylight. My ultimate purpose was to write truthfully, but I was selective about the audience who I thought would get the truth. These two selves developed separate personalities. My internet self was bold, opinionated, and vocal about any social justice topic which required immediate action. My real-life self was a toned-down version of that girl. I was still passionate about social justice, but far more cautious when approaching it in conversation. Always discreet, always afraid, not quite resolute. I saw my internet persona as who I genuinely was. I knew I could communicate clearly about things I cared about, and I cared about social justice more than anything. I simply held back in my day-to-day. I suppressed my inner voice, speaking only in abstract terms and in certain propitious environments. I favored class debates for how technical they were and because required participation could act as an explanation for my passion about these issues. When someone said or did something motivated by a bias against a group of people, my first instinct was to look around to see if another person would engage them on it. Even if no one did, I would still just bite my tongue and shrug, telling myself something like, "It's not worth it," or "Pick your battles," they say. My Instagram profile was packed with artsy photographs of James Baldwin passages, and I could write a lengthy essay on the hazards of white feminism with stark assertiveness. Yet engaging with a friend with radically opposing views, or calling out an acquaintance for saying something discriminatory in regular conversation, that was a challenge. My discomfort in these scenarios was so great that I felt I had no choice but to stay silent. I could easily explain away why I wasn't the right person to speak up. I had always avoided confrontation at all costs. I would dodge every conversation that could end in an ugly argument and or me desperately trying not to angry cry. But I have also steered clear of disagreeable topics with close friends and family members whom I have no doubt would be very tranquil and considerate. It's not that I couldn't find a safe space in real life. It's that none of them felt as safe as the internet. The internet made me feel secure in my self-belief. Everything I wrote seemed infinitely more compelling than what I had to say IRL, because I had an audience of strangers across the globe who were taking their time to read it. Plus, they could disagree with me, but they couldn't really confront me. Any negative comments I could easily ignore. It was absolute bliss. But I felt increasingly uncomfortable with the idea of remaining a bystander when there was a conversation I truly wanted to be a part of happening in front of me. By always expecting other people with my views to chime in, I ended up being disappointed again and again. A lot of times, no one would say anything, and the dialogue would end before even beginning. And then, after a lot of blows, I stopped looking around the room and started to wonder, why am I waiting for someone to speak up? Why don't I? What's there to lose? My silence was a choice, though I had made myself believe it wasn't. By purposely staying away from controversial discussions in real life, I was limiting my voice and my growth as a person. I was succumbing to my insecurities and missing concrete opportunities to advance the causes I care about. The comfort and stimulation I got from the internet made it easy to forget the impact I could have on the people I know and am most likely to seriously engage. My negative commenters online could always just ignore me, too. Talking to people might seem less brave than putting yourself out there online, but it's quite the opposite. Engaging real people in conversation, not declaration, requires one to listen, to be flexible, and to contend with another person's humanity. If someone is intentionally making you feel unsafe or provoking you, there are ways to protect yourself. But the moment of discomfort when someone says or does something uninformed is actually the perfect opportunity to act on your beliefs. Instead of keeping silent and thinking how you'll write about it later, remind yourself of the invaluable possibilities that exist between two people who are willing to learn. Take advantage of this. They are here. They are listening. Choose to say something. Trust it'll matter. This next article is from Glamour magazine, and it's about Maxine Waters, the representative, the California representative in the U.S. House of Representatives. And you will definitely see from this article how she represents speaking up and speaking out. Maxine Waters knew it would come to this. Since 1990, she has represented California in the U.S. House of Representatives. In that time, she has seen President Bill Clinton weather impeachment, President George Bush drag us into endless war, and President Barack Obama survive the scandal of his tan suit. In other words, she can distinguish between real and partisan horror. And she has sounded the alarm on this president for years. In May 2017, she asked, "Why would we let Trump, a con man, come in here and turn it all upside down with his lies and his disrespect?" She would keep at it, she promised, until he's impeached. In September 2017, at comedian Dick Gregory's funeral, Waters said, "When I get through with Donald Trump, he's going to wish he had been impeached." In November 2017, she led more than 1,000 people in an Impeach 45 chant at Glamour's Women of the Year Awards. It took some time, but the House of Representatives has begun to heed her call. But as much as Waters is vindicated, she is also under fire. The representative is a frequent target for such right-wing conservatives as Tucker Carlson, Glenn Beck, and the hordes of internet trolls who follow them. In October 2018, Waters was one of more than a dozen Trump critics who was sent a bomb. In fact, she received two in the mail. She tells Glamour she still gets death threats, but Waters is as resolute as ever. Now is no time to back down. Here, she talks impeachment, Republicans, and what's next for America. What follows is an interview between Glamour magazine and Representative Maxine Waters. Glamour: "From the beginning, you have been a voice in the wilderness warning America about this president." Representative Maxine Waters: "I watched this president all during the primaries and the way that he treated his peers. I watched him talk about grabbing women by their private parts. I've watched him name call. He name called me. I watched him promote violence at his rallies. I watched him embrace Russian President Vladimir Putin and refuse to denounce him even after our intelligence committee basically confirmed that the Russians had hacked into our election system. And now I'm watching him with this telephone call that really has gotten a lot more people into understanding and believing how dangerous he is, how corrupt he is. A tough call where he tried to talk the Ukrainian president into getting involved in some kind of phony investigation so that he could get dirt on former Vice President Joe Biden." Glamour magazine: "Trump has tweeted that the whistleblower should be executed for treason. He suggested a civil war will break out if he is impeached. He has refused to cooperate with this probe. What's going to happen?" Representative Maxine Waters: "We have a president of the United States who would dare create this kind of chaos and danger just for his own self-interest. I'm calling on Republicans also to get this president under control. We need to be worried about that kind of threat. It is awful. It is horrible. It is unacceptable. This man is dangerous. I've always known that he was not worthy of the presidency. He should not be in that seat. And so I started early. And I know that a lot of people thought, why is she talking about impeachment? Maybe they didn't even understand that the Constitution gives us the responsibility to make a determination about whether someone holding that position is dangerous, whether they are worthy, whether or not they are acting in the best interest of their country, whether or not they are lying with foreigners and foreign interests. And he was dangerous before he was president. Look at the way he treated African Americans, denying them the ability to rent the apartments from him and his father, the way that he basically committed fraud and took money from students who thought they could get an education at his fake university. It's just so much." Glamour magazine: "That's the question too, isn't it? There's so much that's been out there. There's so much incredible reporting that's been done to uncover his corruption. So why this? Why now? You've been calling for impeachment since the beginning. Why is this call with Ukraine the thing that pushed people over the edge?" Representative Maxine Waters: "The call connects the dots. I think that it's helped people to understand that really, Trump was asking a foreign power to get involved, to get dirt on what he thought would be his opponent. Then, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who had been against impeachment, saw that more of the members of Congress were saying, oh my goodness, now is the time, and then, of course, the public also has continued to come on board. It's all coming together around the call. And now that we know that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and the Attorney General, William Barr, were involved in this corruption, I believe that this formal inquiry is going to lead to a resolution of impeachment that will be voted on by the House Judiciary Committee. The six committee chairs who have been doing an investigation will be involved in helping to identify what should go into any impeachment resolution. Glamour Magazine. Do you think it will be successful? Representative Waters. I really do. I really believe that. Glamour Magazine. You've experienced the danger of Trump's rhetoric probably more than most people ever have. Just a quick glance at your Twitter shows that this is the kind of vitriol that's been lobbed at you. Last year, you received two bombs in the mail. Are you worried? Representative Waters. In many ways, I feel a bit vindicated. There were some people who didn't understand why I was taking the position and why I was so strong on it. I feel that there's maybe better understanding now. There will always be haters and threats on my life, and so I know that that is out there. I'm not flirting simply with danger for the sake of it, and I have enough sense to do what I can to have security, but I can never let the threat of danger of losing my life even ever stop me from saying and doing what I think makes good politics. So I'm not afraid, and I'm not going to stop saying and doing what I do. I just believe that many folks are now awakened to the danger of this president, and I feel good about it. Glamour Magazine. One argument against impeachment is that many people believe Vice President Mike Pence might be worse than Donald Trump. What do you think? Representative Waters. Pence is a right-wing conservative who has played to the worst elements in our society. What I've said in the past was, after we impeach Trump, we should go after Pence. But Pence is also involved in the scandal because he has been involved with some of the advisors to the Ukrainian president. I think Pence has a lot to answer to. Glamour Magazine. You think Pence will also get tossed out in this impeachment inquiry? Representative Waters. I think that he should be brought to account for what his role has been. Glamour Magazine. Impeachment has not been a very bipartisan effort. There are news reports that some Republicans would vote for impeachment in private. What are you hearing from your colleagues? Representative Waters. Republicans are not going to be able to hide when the case for impeachment is unveiled. I recently got stopped on the floor by a Republican lawmaker who basically said, I haven't always agreed with you, but keep doing what you're doing. Go after it. I think that they are silent because many of them understand that this president deserves to be impeached. Pundits say that the center will never support impeachment, but I've always believed that if we connect the dots, put forward hard facts, and put information out there that cannot be refuted, we can convince them in the end. Glamour Magazine. Isn't that frustrating? Lawmakers expecting you to do all the work while they hide? Representative Waters. I have learned in the many years that I have been involved in politics that we can't count on a lot of people to have courage. And so they do not speak up. They do not stand up. They have to be dragged in, sometimes in the final moments of the decision. But I'm not discouraged. I just listen to what they have to say and think to myself, we'll eventually get you in on this. Glamour Magazine. This week of news has already been insane. Where do we go from here? Representative Waters. I think the focus will be on Pompeo and Rudy Giuliani and Barr and even Pence. I don't know how they're going to legitimately escape having to be subpoenaed, having to get their documents, and having to get their records. I think we're in another era of a possible impeachment in which they could be charged with obstruction, and the consequences of not responding are going to be different. Glamour Magazine. You mean jail? Representative Waters. I don't know exactly. I will be talking with Intelligence Committee about that. If they resist, and they do not want to comply, after we know that they had some role in this, I think they should be arrested. I believe that they should be arrested. Glamour Magazine. What do the American people need to be watching for in this process? Representative Waters. I'm on people to pay attention. I know that over the past 2 years, as information has been revealed, there has been talk about the Kremlin and the oligarchs and the work that was done to deal with so many different individuals who are aligned in some way with Trump. It is tiring and confusing, and there are some people who have been frustrated with the news and who just said, Nothing's going to happen with all this. I just can't deal with this anymore. I want them to pay attention, and I want them to follow it very closely, and I want them to understand exactly what is going on, and what has been said by who, and what is being unveiled about the relationship between Pompeo and Barr and the president, and the effort to get the Ukrainian president involved in the scheme. I'd love for people to just not walk away. This next article is from Literary Hub magazine, and it's called Who Has the Right to Write About Hurricane Katrina? It's by Maggie Neal, and it's an interesting take on who is allowed to write about what subject matter. Basically, who is allowed to stand up and speak out about which things. Moving through Sarah M. Broom's debut, The Yellow House, felt like a homecoming. The author and I are different in many ways, age and race, where we were when Katrina hit, the nature of our connection to New Orleans, where we are in our writing lives. Still, the book resonated, deeply, harshly. Broom's stated desire to write about Katrina was something I recognized. I, too, have long had this writing impulse. Typically, I find my written words grasping at concrete details, usually of my family's evacuation the day before the hurricane. There are bits of memory, some of which I recall with certainty, and others that I may have fabricated, embellished, or absorbed from someone else's retelling. The fragments are personal, private bits of information that feel weighty, like the color and make of the car, what time we left, what music played in the background as I saw my own yellow house recede into the distance, whether or not I brought my ninth grade geometry book to study for the Monday quiz that I would never take, what the traffic was like, whether or not it was raining when we first left, yet they never seem to be enough to even begin to fully understand or explain to others so that they might understand. Why do we write about loss, and how do we do it? I've often wondered this. I felt a similar grappling in The Yellow House, where Broom's way of answering comes out in decisions around form and craft. As an epigraph to the penultimate movement of the book, Broom quotes Adrian Rich. The thing I came for, the wreck, and not the story of the wreck, the thing itself, and not the myth. These are layered verses in the context of Katrina and Broom's book, and I kept coming back to them as Broom progressed with the narrative, triggering in me new ways of thinking about my own writing craft of the past 14 years. Immediately, I recognized the desire to get to the wreck, the thing itself, so restrained in Rich's verses, so feral in my own self. I remember learning years ago in a philosophy class about the noumenon, defined as the thing itself, essence, object, existing regardless of human life and perception. It has often felt that if I could simply repeat on paper the exact event as it happened, I could document and thus capture Katrina's noumenon, photograph it, or boil it down and reduce it to its parts, even a single letter, the hurricane, Katrina, K, as I've read people still living in New Orleans do now, or give it a new name, the water, as Broom does. Maybe her throat, chest, esophagus clench as mine do, even typing the word Katrina. Maybe then this thing that feels so vast, painful, inexplicable, that is made to feel more so by media and myth, this thing that hurtled into my life and millions of others, maybe then, captured and renamed, it'll be utterable, knowable, understandable, the death, the trauma, the injustice, the loss. This desire to capture is an artistic impulse linked to a healing impulse, as if in transforming all of it into a work of art, we could suture the parts of our psyches that feel as though they burst apart when the wind and rain and floodwaters storm through our lives, altering forever their course. Hungry, curious eyes wanting to know, was my house destroyed? Are you for real? They seem to ask. But I recognize that this thing itself, the wreck, the water, K, whatever it is, cannot be captured, not fully. At one point, Broom quotes Beckett, a reference to euphemism and the breakdown of language, to facing not meaning, but the stark realization of its absence. Words in the hands of writers are supposed to be transcendent. Craft is supposed to help describe the concrete through choice and order which accumulates into form. But what if we are trying to describe not presence, but absence, which cannot be seen, but can be felt in a place just beyond the reach of words? Broom toggles between concrete and abstract. Between what is there, she's a journalist and relies heavily on the real, with archival documents, photographs, recordings to that effect, and absence. This tension comes to a head in her big question, the title of Movement 4, Do You Know What It Means? I couldn't help but think of Louis Armstrong's lament, Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans? As though asking a question were the only way to call attention to the impossibility of the answer. Formally, the water comes hurtling smack in the middle. It's a book that pays attention to form, and so I wonder if she feels that trauma, as someone once told me, can be defined as the thing that splices everything into a before and an after, affecting all of it. I continue to experience the hurricane as an unfolding story, not a photograph after all, but a film that moves backwards and forwards. Temporality, beginnings and endings, are skewed. In trying to reconstruct a narrative timeline, we are led to more questions. When do we know when the storm hit? Was it the storm clouds, the drizzle, the rain, the eerie calm of the eye? Or was it the panic, the boarding up of windows, the news reports? I don't know how to make sense of things without thinking of the water. Or I don't know which parts of my life only make sense because of it. How we evacuated to Houston, bringing a few pieces of clothing, leaving behind my father's books, a PhD's worth of a library that we spent hours piling on higher shelves, waking up in the middle of the night in a squalid Texas hotel room, watching the news reports, understanding before I knew for sure that we were not going back. We were going north. Another first day of ninth grade. Hungry, curious eyes wanting to know, was my house destroyed? Are you for real? They seemed to ask. Moving onwards, more north still, to New York, to Connecticut. We use the simple past tense when we say the hurricane hit, but this is the wrong way about it because it implies decisive action and clear ending. I often think of how the destruction was largely due to water, an element that literally seeps everywhere, changing the texture, color, feel, smell of everything it comes across. Liquid, seeping into all parts of my life. I don't know how to make sense of things without thinking of the water. Or, I don't know which parts of my life only make sense because of it. The Yellow House itself was written over time, 8 years, and officially begun 6 years after the hurricane, though Broom borrows from diary entries and family memories that predate everything. A central aim of Broom's book is to retell the story of New Orleans, whose mythology as the Big Easy obscured the city's rotten, racist bones. Broom's journalistic methods allow her to get concrete, if not to capture the thing itself, then in order to investigate the destruction of certain poor and primarily black neighborhoods. This includes her own house in New Orleans East, an area often overlooked, its authenticity a part of New Orleans questioned by those outside it. Yes, the hurricane caused damage, but racist policies and practices in the immediate aftermath, as well as decades prior, assured destruction and protracted displacement of some of the city's poorest. Amidst formidable ambitions of historic and collective justice, Broom questions whether she has the right to authorship. Who has the right to tell the story of a place? Because she was not there when the hurricane hit. She did not evacuate. She did not live in New Orleans for a long time. I want to allow myself to hold simultaneously the gratitude and shame of surviving, of leaving before things got really bad when so many others could not. Like Broom, I too have questioned my right to write about evacuating in Katrina. I lived in New Orleans as a young white girl. My house was a different yellow house in a different part of town. Where I lived, people did not wonder if the government had purposely blown up levees in order to protect other richer neighborhoods deemed more valuable. I wasn't born in New Orleans, and neither were any of my ancestors. I lived there as I was still growing up, so my ticket to being an insider, the knowledge of a place that comes with living there, is limited. That of a place seen through the eyes of a child. Cafeterias and schoolyards, ma'am and y'all and Miss First Name spoken with the soft inflections of a warm accent, painting Sarah Vaughan's face on a mural of musicians, greedily stuffing crawfish in my mouth, the stench on my red hands afterwards that I secretly loved, picnics on the levee, my little sisters following me as I walked on sidewalks made jagged and cracked by live oaks. But I left, and I don't have roots there. Unless you count memories as roots. I do not want a personal linear narrative to overshadow a collective one. I want to recognize that they are braided. I want to allow myself to hold simultaneously the gratitude and shame of surviving, of leaving before things got really bad when so many others could not, alongside the spectral, lingering feeling of my own disappeared, amputated early life. Like Broom, I would like to not avert my eyes. For all of these reasons, it seems to me important that formally Broom's book is just that, a book, a sometimes messy melange of genres, visual and written, that feels quite literally stitched together, a suturing of dispersed pieces. The book allows for narrative duration and pluralism of voices and mediums. If trying to simply capture a chain of events serves an impulsive desire for immediate satisfaction, the book form instead allows for thinking about loss and catastrophe, absence, trauma, and injustice in a more expansive and messier fashion, mirroring more closely the feeling of living and processing after such an event. Reading, I felt a bond. The parallels in our experience, mixed with the space she opens for multiple stories to coexist, felt like permission for me to go back psychically, to express, and to write. Broom's Yellow House was destroyed as a result of the dual efforts of Katrina and bad policy. The Yellow House is the protagonist, but also one of many houses which come up in this book. Houses are about history. Black history, American history, New Orleans history, and they are about families. Physical shelter. Home is also deeply symbolic and internal, spiritual. By Broom's own assertion, shelters in God and writing in our insides are inextricably linked. It's no wonder that to lose a house is so devastating. I recently went back to New Orleans for the first time in 10 years. My house isn't yellow anymore. And the outside structure has changed. It's not as kempt. I wanted to see inside. Before I could get to the front door, I came across a new gate, the kind you put at the top of stairs so your dog or baby don't get into trouble. I fiddled with it for minutes that felt like hours, but it would not unlock. So I walked away, back down the steps, noticing wood rotting in places, thinking it was just as well. Who knows what the new owners are like? Letting the realization sink in that I was locked out of a home where I'd grown up, a space that had once been sacred. All right, folks, it's raining outside. I thought that would be a good article to end on since we're about to get some bad weather here in North Carolina. But we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thanks and good night.